earthly fuse. The island air seems to shift between cold and warm. Jean wonders if what she feels is only the heat of her imagination or the island is venting. Standing there on the solid ground, she feels a sudden pulse of nausea, and she coughs until everything in her stomach comes up and out on the ash. Wait until you are on dry land to be seasick, Mark says. Allison watches her, goes to her side, pats her back while Jean's bent double. Afterward, Jean buries her bile with a few kicks, covering it with the island's moon-like dust. Jean looks toward the center at the spire of smoke coming out of the cone. It's steadily rising, but there's no lava, no danger that she can see. But being this close to the smoke itself, a few city blocks distant, is alarming. They gather their material together, their tents, the cooler, and the banner, and march through the tephra. By the time they're seated at the top of the little slope, their clothes are powdered with gray. The air smells like sulfur and salt water. It's humid, but every few moments as the breeze shifts, the wind flanks Jean and turns oven dry. She is inside an elixir, a potion in the form of territory. The point now is to wait for the communicator to work its way through the channels of reportage and security, all the way to where they are, to the place that makes them illegal by being there. Standing, walking, waiting, thinking, peopling it. Being people where they shouldn't be, waiting for time to bring them in. They expect helicopters eventually, and each of them at different times steals a furtive look into the sky at the eastern horizon in the direction of the city. Police helicopters, news helicopters. The former will come to take them away, the latter to take their images from here to put on screens everywhere else. That's how big the plan is, how expansive, yet how small. Their banner reads, Unceded Native Land. Red spray paint on Fletcher's repurposed bedsheet. A couple poles. Poles so the wind doesn't belly it. Lift it. Set it sailing. Jean notices a pocked boulder the size of a newspaper box that rests half buried in the ash several meters down the shore. It occurs to her that at some point, months earlier, that great chunk of stone flew out of the volcano and landed there. It's painted over with white bird shit, she sees, but there are no seabirds on the island. She spots a gull out there above the water, but it just glides past. It passes them up like it knows something. The column of smoke is in the center like an axis, at this moment leaning nowhere. Allison takes a piece of paper out of her back pocket and unfolds it. Dara drew this, she says, holding it with both hands. Jean looks at the crayon drawing of the island and notices that Dara has drawn six human figures on the beach. She's got them all in different shades of brown and gold under a cream-colored sun. Dara has put herself there, alongside them on the island, the smallest of the smiling stick people. Though Jean knows she is with Allison's mom. Allison finishes drinking from a plastic water bottle and tips it upside down, draining out the last drops. She kneels down and scoops aside some of the ashy ground, digs out a hole. She refolds Dara's drawing, then rolls it into a scroll and slips it into the container. She caps it and drops the bottle in the hole, covers it over. Maybe one of those scientists will come across it, she says, smiling. My girl will end up in the Museum of Anthropology. Authentic First Nations glyphs from one of the lesser coastal islands. Jean laughs, and then she tells Allison. The beat of the surf intensifies, or maybe Jean has just noticed it. It's crashing faster, even though the tide is receding. She looks to the shoreline, but turning her head makes her dizzy, nauseous. It's either her sickness or the sound, but something is bending. Then she realizes that what she's hearing is not the tide, but the thrum of blades. On the horizon, they can now clearly see the shapes of two boats and a helicopter above closing in from the east. The chopper's windscreen is lit by rays of orange. The helicopter moves ferociously fast. They can only stand and watch it. It flies over them, terrifyingly low. They all instinctively dive to the ground, lie on their bellies as it roars past. A rain of paper comes down upon them. Leaflets. The same text over and over. It begins, How to Surrender. They turn on the radio. Not a word about them yet. Then Allison's cell phone goes off. They're all quiet as she takes it out and looks at it until it stops. Then it rings again. She throws it into the surf, sidearm. It skips beautifully three times. The argument. It's so far being all police, all the boats and aircraft. They've obviously grounded the media. The island's relative inaccessibility is the cause of this flaw in their plan. No media, no point. They must at least rate a single photograph. Fletcher says they need time. Someone will break through. Some telephoto lens will bust the cordon and get their image. It's inevitable. Cops can't police the whole ocean. You can practically windsurf your way down here. We need to buy time. They need to delay the takedown that's on the way, but no one is sure how to do it. Fletcher stares at the ground. He says to it, right. He's around the other side of the cone, scanning the sea and sky. The chopper is gone for now, but the two boats float out there, not yet moving in. Fletcher walks further along the beach, across from one of the vessels. The others watch him as he shuffles around down the shore. He's limping, Gene thinks. He's dragging the toe of his combat boot through the littoral ash, turning here and there. It's like he's gliding across a ballroom floor. Soft shoe or Indian style, she can't decide. Either, both, or he's cracking up. Later, on the mainland, after, she will see on a screen a photograph that will by then be famous, impossibly taken from a bird's eye point of view. Jean will read in the picture the lie Fletcher wrote in the sand to keep the law away. We are armed. The island's first dance. The cordon breaks. News helicopters and all manner of boats. The cops come alive. The occupiers only now see multiple figures on the decks out there. The blue and white helicopter is on its way, they know, purely by the feeling of unleashing that surrounds them. Jean goes to Fletcher. There's not much time, so she takes his hand, puts it on her belly, and says it all. A new life, theirs. She didn't say before because she wanted to be here, and the group might not have let her come. Blades beat apart the air, and ash rises around the five. They stand and look up at the helicopter and hear a voice from a loudhailer command them to stand apart, to turn around, to put their hands behind their heads, to fall to their knees, to put one ankle over the other, to remain motionless. They don't. The sound of the chopper is deafening as it hovers. The men with the weapons rappel down and storm toward them through a blizzard of ash. When she feels the barrel of the AR-15 jab into her sternum, she hears Fletcher shout, no. She's on the ground, a knee on her spine, ash in her eyes, and the sound of shouting, the blades breaking the sky, and a rush, or a whoosh, or an exhalation. A change in the space around her. Is the island erupting? It's only in memory later that she hears the blast, an explosion in her recollection, audibly vaster than it could really have been. She rehears the gunfire in the cochlea of her mind, the sound that takes him. She can't see anything, but feels her wrists being zip-tied, then her whole body being netted in something, the force of a man moving her body against her will. Then she is rising. She's in some kind of harness, and it's lifting from the ground. Then she is moving through the air. She forces open her eyes, and through a blur, she can distinguish the island's outline, its shore, an appendage of dust leaning out from the beach she was standing on a moment ago. The ocean is blindingly brilliant, and though her wrists and her ankles burn from their bindings, she's flying. She's moving over the face of the water like a fragment of an explosion broken free of its form.
You have been listening to Wade Compton read from his newest book, The Outer Harbor.
I wrote a draft of a novel that didn't really work. And so, you know, I realized after writing, you know, many thousands of words, up to 2 years of working on it, that I don't really know how to write fiction or something sustained like that. And so I thought, I did that thing where you write all of this stuff and then write up to the, you know, you write your way up to the moment you realize the novel should start, and that all of that other stuff is just kind of background stuff, and now here's the start. So it's kind of like Sisyphus, right? You rolled the rock, and it just rolls back down, and you're like, I don't want to do that for another 2 years, so And so I made a decision to write some short stories and just sort of think about, because I've really been writing poetry mostly, right? So I made a deliberate decision to write some short stories and try to think about narrative and think about how I want to do that. And so that was the very beginning. And then and then I just start collecting up some stories. But I often say, when I teach creative writing, I say, you know, I have one graph, really, in one graph that I'll ever teach. Creative writing needs one graph, which is a line, right? And I say, you know, the line is from here to here, from, you know, point A to point Z in the process of writing something, I think. Usually what happens, you have an idea of what you're going to write, what you think you're going to write, what you want to write, and then at some point between those two points, something goes wrong. It falls apart, it fails, so you realize it's not going to be what you wanted it to be. And you know, the number one thing I have to teach about it, I think, is that that's the best point. That feels terrible, it always feels bad, and it is a failure of that original vision, but I think that's where, if you work through that, that's where the really cool stuff comes, because that's sort of where you, where the things that are more than you come into the piece, right? The stuff that is sort of mysterious or you've suppressed, but it comes out anyway, that's the moment. And it feels like a failure of your original vision, but if you kind of look at it closely, it's often really interesting. And so I think I just sort of did that intuitively. For this book, I'd kind of thought about that, and I was trying to figure it out, and I realized, I thought, well, this book didn't really have one of those moments. And then I thought, well, the way to identify the moment is think of the moment that felt worst, like the moment you felt the most frustrated and angry that it was being this, and that's probably the moment. And sure enough, it is. And the moment of maximum frustration in the process of writing this was the moment when I had all the stories together and then realized they were all linked. Because some of them were linked and some of them weren't. And then I suddenly realized they all have to be linked, and I could see how it was done. And I didn't want that to be true, because I knew, because I told Brian I was going to give him the manuscript in January, and then over the Christmas break I had this realization and thought, this is going to be another year of work. But is it not done, right? So that was the moment. So realizing it was all linked up. And it was like in a moment, I just suddenly saw, well, that's how they're all the same thing, right? And, so that's how that happened, painfully. That's the short answer.
How does the process of writing fiction for you compare to the process of writing poetry? And does poetry fail in the same way that prose fails?
Yeah. For me, it does. Everything fails. That I think you occasionally get like a gift from the gods where you just something tumbles out, you know. Mm-hmm. But you get those like every one, you know, once or twice in a lifetime, maybe. I don't know if I've even had one. Well, I'm not really sure. But most things have that point. It can be really traumatic or kind of small. I like to think I'm getting better at managing it because I try not to freak out. I think that's the main thing, you know, freak out. Because they can just make you scuttle the project. Like that earlier novel I talked about, I probably could have worked my way through that, but at that time I hadn't really had that realization, so I just gave up on it, right? So now I don't. If there's some big traumatic destruction of the project, I kind of calm myself down and think about, well, what's the good in this? This is something better than what I'm doing, actually, most of the time. Poetry is the same. For me, what's funny about the difference between poetry, because I have books now of poetry, nonfiction, and fiction, and they're all kind of the same sort of writing process, but I find the main difference is I can't write poetry, I have to write poetry in complete silence. Like I need to be in a library or somewhere where it's completely quiet, but I can write nonfiction in a noisy cafe. In fact, I prefer it. So people can be talking around me, music can be playing, I can have a lot of other sounds and things coming in, and fiction is kind of in between. It's really in between those things. That's the only difference, which is worthless to anyone else but me. It's entirely subjective. Yes.
I think you can feel that kind of rhythmical language. You know, there's a real care of the sentence and even the phrase and then hearing it read as well, that doesn't feel like it's a great distance from the poetry, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wanted it to be, yeah, that was pretty deliberate. I wanted it to be read differently than, yeah, but it still does, it does, yeah, I don't know, it is in there. It's part of the, you know, the DNA of my syntax or something like that.
When you write a collection of linked stories, how do you choose which will be first and which will be last?
Yeah. That was tough because, in fact, that's, so I spent that year that I'm talking about obsessively arranging and rearranging the order. It's gone through every permutation you can think of. But it was almost like a video game or something, like, you know, it was just changing around, and then some would lock into place, like some would be like, chunk, and it's like, okay, that's there, and in each permutation it seems to want to stay there once I figured it out, and then they all sort of lined up in a certain order. But that's because I was revising them, and every time you revise something, you sort of switch around the logic of something else, and so that was kind of tough, but I was doing that right up until kind of the last moments, but then because I was revising it until the last moments, but certain ones were in their place for quite a while, and funnily enough, I'd say the last story, which I think is maybe in some ways the most complicated story, because it's got a bunch of different types of discourse and different characters and different speakers, and then images. They're also images as part of the text. It looks to me now, objectively looking at it later, like one of the harder things to write in it, but it was one of the easiest. And I think it's because I wrote it last. It is the very last thing I wrote, and it was after I understood it as being linked. And so it just tumbled out. That was maybe the easiest thing to write, because I felt maybe the trauma had come before or something like that, so it just sort of moved through. The last stages of things, I mean, I say, in my graph, right, I say, the beginning, you have different emotions at different points in the graph. At the beginning of the graph, when you're starting a project, you need to be, full of yourself. You need to be kind of arrogant, on the point of arrogance, to think that you can pull this off, like you're going to write a story or you're going to write a novel or something like that. It seems to me outrageously arrogant to think that I can do that. And so you have to sort of summon up whatever it is in you that you think you can do this thing. And then as you go, and after that point of the trauma and sort of reconciling with that, you get, that goes away. You no longer feel in control of things or like you're calling the shots, and you move further and further towards humility before the project, as it takes over and you serve it, really, right? You serve this project, and you just kind of have to trust that it knows what it's doing, and, you know, it sort of smacks you in the face and tells you to do something else. You're doing it wrong. It drives you at that point. So that one was maybe easy because I was completely beaten down by the, reconciled to the fact that it was going to be what it wanted to be.
I'll just ask. So, what are your thoughts on being a part of literary contests like Canada Reads?
Yeah. Well, I'm not. So.
Were you a part of Canada Reads?
No.
At any point?
No.
Oh. Okay. Well,
it's easy to ask.
You want to nominate?
I haven't thought about it.
I'm taking a class, an English class, and we're reading. One of your books, and it's only material that's been nominated for Canada.
Really?
So,
they didn't tell me. Publisher.
Okay, I guess that's that.
What book? What?
It's your recent one, the one you just read on.
Canada Reads. No. I would have known that. I pay very close attention to that.
Professor.
Yeah. She's my baby. Yeah. I don't know.
That's Sophie, right? Yeah.
Well,
I think
so. Yeah, it's wishful. But you know, I don't know. I have a friend. I mean, Stephen Galloway is a writer. You know, has basically said, you know, every time it comes around, the nominations come around on Facebook, and people are nominating each other and saying what should be and this and that. And he posted something saying, "Why on earth would an author want their book to be subjected to this process? Right? Just leave me out of it. No thanks." So I don't know, actually, because I haven't listened to it for years. So I have no idea what goes on Canada Reads. What do? They talk about the book. And...
Yeah, they got bigger and abandoned.
Yeah. The last one I listened to was the one where Justin Trudeau was defending Hubert Akan, which is such a weird weird thing for me. Anyway, that's the last one, so that's a long time ago. Like 10, 15 years ago or something. It was alright. I read that book because of it. Bizarrely, so yeah. I don't care.
I have a question about the work you just read. Forgive me for being stumbly because I'm trying to think that I haven't been exposed to before, so I'm just thinking out loud. But I was really struck by the kind of relationship between time as a character in the story, and the kind of way that time was synchronized with power, that there was the characters who were seeking to claim the space. This island is like claiming the future. Mm-hmm. There was so much birth happening in the story. Mm-hmm. There was the birth of the island, the birth, the pregnancy, and the grappling with the geologic language was learning a new language to navigate these spaces being born. Mm-hmm. And then it really kind of hit me when they put up a banner on a bed sheet that said unceded native land, which is recalling a time kind of before and through contact of a parallel kind of existence in colonial society. Mm-hmm. And the bed sheet thing is just so old-style activism that it's that is like this traditional appeal to. And so I felt like these characters were living between, like, those were spaces of resistance or comfort for them. And on the opposite side, there was the faceless dominant society that was present tense. That never gets, like, there's no embodiment of that society in this story at all. And sorry, I just wonder about this.
Yeah, no, I thought about time and space a lot. That you know, I mean, if there's a dominant theme, it's space. So I was really thinking about Vancouver and how space is politicized and how it's, you know, dominated by power and inflected by power. But yeah, once you get into that, you get into time as well, and, you know, periods. And the stories, I mean, that's another thing in terms of the order of the stories. They go from 2001 to 2025, so a good bit into the future. And so it's a kind of parallel timeline, I guess, right? Where it breaks off at a certain point. I mean, this story I have set in 2006 is when it's happening. And there are some very slight things that indicate the time a little bit. Yeah, definitely. And that's also something that I took from the Pauline Johnson story. I mean, that story is about... So the Lost Island in that story is this island that literally peers and disappears in different parts in Indian Arm, not in the outer harbor, but in the inlet, right, in different places. And so the idea is, so Joe Capilano talks about, you know, seeing it once when he was out paddling, and then, but getting close to it, and then it disappears, and that's sort of the story. It's there, it comes and goes. And then you learn later on that really the allegory of the island is that it's the resurgence of the people, right? So the people are conquered, but they will come back. This island will reappear, right? And that's sort of a symbol. And I think that's, you know, kind of what I was thinking of too throughout the book, right? Is that things, and also Kamau Brathwaite has this theory called tidalectics, where he takes the term dialectics and sort of revises it in an Africanist kind of mode, and he says that, you know, dialectics are part of the problem of the West, this idea of thinking that things must perpetually progress, right? And that things must, and that you sort of have to kill, it's like as if sort of killing the ancestors so that you can create something new. And he says that doesn't work for someone coming up through kind of an Africanist way of thinking. He says it's more like you are the ancestors, and you're this generation, and you're all of those generations, and it's more like a tide. It's a repetition, right? As a model, he prefers that, and that's really stuck with me over the years. that things are sort of, so I think there's a lot of that kind of, you know, surging and then a kind of receding. And the idea is that, you know, if we are defeated here, if we must retreat here, it's so that we can return in another form, or someone else will, you know, and I think that's the, I think that's sort of what I was thinking about that. I mean, after the story, what happens to the island, it gets increasingly absurd and weird. It becomes that they put condos on it. I imagine Vision Vancouver, maybe he's still in power, 2025, and put condos on it as they might, and which is a bit absurd, but I try to make it, you know, imagine if they really did that, and there's one of the stories set in the condo, a couple of us bought one of the units, but then it doesn't work. There's some kind of unspecified economic crash, and the market bottoms out, and nobody lives in the condo anymore. And then there's these migrants that show up off the coast of BC, and there's something dangerous about them. And so the government at the time turns the condo into an internment camp, right? Basically a detention center, a special detention center, and they end up being housed in there. And so it gets weirder and stranger and closer to surreal as the book goes. But it was all me thinking, it's kind of this accelerated version of what has happened, really, in a lot of ways.
Wade Compton is the Program Director of Creative Writing at Simon Fraser University Continuing Studies. His newest book, The Outer Harbor, is a collection of short fiction.
Thank you to Obadiah for that interview and recording here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. I'm Jesse. Up next is Democracy Now!, and we're going to hear just a little bit of music to get us all the way through until the top of the hour. And we're going to hear some more local music from Miguel Maravilla. This is from his Always LP, which follows up the Always EP, and is nearly 8 years of working on fragments of the same word, same idea, same sound, and now it's finally done. 48 songs compartmentalized into 18, or one song recorded and reiterated 48 times. This is Always You by Miguel Maravilla.
Oh,